This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. While coastal cities like New York and San Francisco have seen both population and economic growth since the 2008 recession, much of the rest of the country has stagnated. One possibility for stimulating economic growth in the creation of affordable housing in struggling parts of the country is a new statute that was passed as part of the tax overhaul last December. The idea is to create opportunity zones in low-income communities across the country, and governors recently submitted their proposed zones to the U.S. Treasury. Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Noah Buhire goes into the details of opportunity zones and their potential impacts on surrounding communities in a new piece headlined, "New Tax Break for Poor Neighborhoods Could Benefit Luxury Developers." Noah, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Like I did with the last interview, we're going to start this interview with a definition. What is an opportunity zone?
An opportunity zone is something that was created in the tax overhaul that got passed late last year. They're essentially low-income communities or communities that are adjacent to low-income communities that governors selected and submitted to Treasury to be eligible for some pretty generous tax breaks if investors build real estate there or fund a business there.
Mm-hmm. And what specifically could be built in these zones, or is it just open-ended?
It's pretty open-ended. We are still waiting for Treasury to write all of the guidelines on this, but the statute is quite broadly written. Basically, all sorts of real estate would be eligible, though you need to make substantial improvements. There's some language about, you know, you can't just go buy a building in one of these areas and sit on it and expect to get these tax breaks. But if you start a company in one of these areas and, you know, hire people, you can get some deferral on capital gains taxes. And also, if you hold stock in that business for more than 10 years, you may not have to pay any capital gains on the appreciation.
Are there any spelled out requirements in terms of like hiring people from the area? Is it spelled out, you know, who is eligible to be hired? They have to be from the community, and or they have to be low income, or they anything like that?
The law really doesn't say anything about that. Mm-hmm. And just to take a step back, an important thing to note here is that the proponents of this measure really wanted to reduce the amount of red tape that would be involved in the sort of economic and community development programs that we've seen in the past. This is an attempt to have a much more market-driven approach, a way that will hopefully entice more private capital to come into areas that haven't seen so much of that. Mm-hmm. Now, the flip side of that coin, as I point out in my piece, is that a lot of people who've worked on community and economic development over the years, people who worry about displacement of poorer residents in cities like San Francisco and L.A., they're quite worried that this is a very laissez-faire approach that might actually end up exacerbating displacement. Uh-huh. So that's really the tension here.
Right. So Noah, given the market-driven nature of this statute, who came up with this plan?
Well, it actually has an interesting origin. So the group that came up with the idea, it was formulated in a white paper a couple of years ago by an organization called the Economic Innovation Group, which is funded and started by Sean Parker, the Napster creator and first president of Facebook. He got together with some like-minded people, and they sort of hatched this idea of trying to get private capital into areas of the country that really hadn't seen a lot of investment since the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm glad you brought him up, because I wanted to talk about this Economic Innovation Group. And in this white paper, they write that our ambitious vision was to create a new asset class. What is an asset class?
I think that was actually Steve Glickman, the CEO of EIG, in an interview to me. But in asset class, his idea basically is that, you know, stocks are an asset class, bonds are an asset class. Their idea was that making these sort of socially minded investments in areas of the country that are distressed, that should be its own sort of asset class, and that it, you know, the whole point of this being in the tax law is that you're actually giving incentives from a tax standpoint for people to be doing this investment in specific parts of the country that governors think need it.
So there's this push to bring investment to areas of the country where there is an investment, and creating this new asset class, which just on paper sounds good, but it also sounds completely divorced and separate from all the other issues involved in development, such as displacement, where are the workers going to come from, what are going to happen to the people who are in these areas. Did they express any kind of thought for the consequences of what these opportunity zones would create?
Yeah, I would actually say that the boosters of this proposal, including EIG and some, you know, big affordable housing developers, they're aware of the potential negative consequences. What this really boils down to is whether you think more good is going to come out of this than the bad. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of interesting facets of this. I think that's a real question, and it's, you know, up for debate, and we're going to have to see over time what sorts of investments actually get made. What is so interesting to me about this program is at the end of the day, there's nothing in the statute that requires reporting on what kinds of investments and which groups are making these investments. So there's not going to be a central, at least for now, there's no plans to be a central clearinghouse for what kinds of investments are being made. So it's going to be particularly hard to evaluate that balance between positive and negative consequences if you don't have the data.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, you call it there's no central clearinghouse. And to me, it's there's no accountability. These investors are getting all of these things, tax breaks and reduced regulation, and they make all these promises on paper. But at least right now, there doesn't seem to be any mechanism in place to hold Company X accountable for not fulfilling pledges and promises X, Y, and Z.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, because the Treasury still has to draft some guidelines, and there may be some requirements in there that, you know, make certain kinds of activities, you know, that if people do certain things, they won't be able to claim this tax benefit. We just don't know yet on all of the rules of the road here. Mm-hmm. What is interesting to me, and I pointed this out in my piece, is that there's a tension when the governors were selecting opportunity zones, and they made nominations. Treasury has to approve those nominations. What we've seen in the areas where Treasury has already approved opportunity zones are, you know, a number of areas where investment is already sort of taking place. So I pointed out in my story the Arts District in L.A. I mean, this is an area where you're seeing lofts, you're seeing hip restaurants. On paper, it is a low-income community. There are low-income residents there, but there's been an enormous amount of capital flowing into a place like that because it's become trendy, and there's already momentum there. And you could say, okay, well, we're just going to encourage more momentum there in that community by creating an opportunity zone. But the downside is, like, that probably would have happened anyway, so why are we mm-hmm. providing a tax break for that?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about, you just mentioned opportunity zone. So now what is an opportunity fund?
Yeah, that's a great question. So these are the vehicles, these are the investment vehicles that are going to be building real estate or funding businesses in opportunity zones. And the statute basically has a very broad definition for them. They're a corporation or a partnership that holds 90% of its assets in in qualified opportunity zones. And there are a couple additional restrictions in the law, and we'll probably get a few more from Treasury about the rules of the road. But you know, the analysts and tax experts I spoke to for this story think that, you know, the way it's written in the statute is very, very broad. It's gonna allow a wide range of private investors, be it individuals, real estate companies, corporations, to actually organize opportunity funds of their own and make investments through them.
And so, because the rules of the road haven't been written, we don't know what provisions there might be to ensure that those investments are actually made and that those companies are held accountable for fulfilling their promises.
Yeah, I think there will be some accountability, and they will have to, you know, the Treasury and IRS don't want outright fraud here. The question is, there's you know, fraud on one level, but then there's probably a whole class of stuff that just might not adhere to the spirit of the law, and this idea that we're trying to lift up communities that you know, really could use a shot in the arm.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I was reading about this, I kept thinking about the 1990s, the Clinton administration, and now former Congressman Charlie Rangel pushing very hard and succeeding in getting economic empowerment zones around the country, particularly here in New York, and the incredible effect that they had in helping to foster the then latest Harlem revival. How is this new iteration, this opportunity zone, different from the effort 20 years ago, almost 30 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I am not enough of an expert on the previous efforts, but I will say this: when EIG, the Economic Innovation Group, came up with this policy or this sort of framework for a policy a couple years ago, the whole reason for writing that paper was looking back at the recent history of economic and community development programs and seeing where they fell short. And one of the big things that they point out in that paper is that there were often in past efforts the structures and ways in which private investors were supposed to put money to work in these areas, it was often too complicated. There was a lot of bureaucracy or red tape, and that actually prevented those programs from really getting as much capital as they could have to areas in need.
And Noah, I got to ask you about, you write about Georgia, and concerns being voiced about how Georgia has situated some of its opportunity zones. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, we picked the Atlanta area because it was illustrative of what a researcher pointed out to me, is that it would be possible for a corporation like Amazon, as they build HQ2, to make opportunity funds a vehicle for building that new campus. And we looked at the Atlanta area because it's one of the finalists for Amazon's second headquarters, and pointed out on the map where the opportunity zones were and where some of the potential locations for HQ2 might be, just to show that there's this interplay and between this new tax break and what, you know, a major corporation is thinking about doing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, the key thing in your whole piece is that this whole new opportunity zone structure was made in the last tax bill, and Treasury is still writing up the rules. And right now, there is no requirement for Treasury or the IRS on these zones and the companies that are participating to report how much money is flowing in and what they're doing to have the tax breaks that they get.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's one thing that's interesting that came out after my article ran. The IRS put out some guidelines on how do you you know, what do you need to do if you create an opportunity fund in terms of your taxes, and this was just in a, you know, an FAQ page on their website, and they basically said that you know, if you want to create an opportunity fund, you're going to get to self-certify. The IRS is going to provide a piece of paper. You're going to fill it out. And as long as you meet, you know, fill it out correctly and meet the standards, then you staple this to your tax return at the end. Now, this might seem like a technical thing, but someone in the affordable housing community pointed out to me that this is basically the IRS saying that they're not going to do any data gathering up front. We're just going to know, you know, the IRS is going to know after people file their taxes next year who has claimed this. And, you know, some people would say that's a missed opportunity to actually know what's going on and the impact of this program.
Well, right. I mean, self-certification, I mean, that is, to me, it's rife with possibilities for corruption.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be careful there because
that's me saying it, not you.
Yeah, there's an audit function, and the IRS can audit people. But I think the bigger issue is that you're going to want to evaluate what is the efficacy of this program. Is what was promised what's actually being delivered?
Right.
And Noah, if you don't have the data, you can't do that.
Noah Buchheyer of Bloomberg Businessweek, thank you very much for being here talking about his new report, A New Tax Break for Poor Neighborhoods Could Benefit Luxury Developers. Noah, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.